even countries that don't extradite, such as the countries of the European Union and the United States, are countries where Russians have assassins who have been killing people and unsuccessfully trying to assassinate people on a pretty large scale. So being on the wanted list of a country that sends assassins to the Western world is not a cozy feeling.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen. Mein Name ist Caroline Ehmke. Schön, dass ich Sie wieder begrüßen darf zu einer neuen Folge von In aller Ruhe, meinem Podcast für die Süddeutsche Zeitung. Diesmal ist Mascha Gessen zu Gast. Es ist das erste Gespräch bei In aller Ruhe, das ich auf Englisch führen werde. Das hatte ich mir von Anfang an gewünscht, dass es ab und an bei besonderen internationalen Gästen, die uns einen anderen Blick auf die Welt vermitteln können, möglich sein würde, auch einmal einen englischen Podcast zu haben. Mascha Gessen ist journalistisch und schriftstellerisch tätig, hoch dekoriert mit zahlreichen Preisen für Texte in der Zeitschrift New Yorker oder auch Bücher. Zuletzt Die Zukunft ist Geschichte, wie Russland die Freiheit gewann und verlor. In unserem Gespräch haben Mascha Gessen und ich über Hannah Arendts Begriff des Totalitarismus gesprochen. Darüber, was es bedeutet, von Putin auf die Most Wanted Liste gesetzt und angeklagt zu werden. Und über das Schreiben über Verbrechen gegen die Menschlichkeit. Hi, I am delighted to welcome my guest today, the American-Russian writer and thinker Mascha Gessen. Thank you, Mascha, for being on the program.
It is a pleasure to be on the program.
Let me begin by congratulating you. You've just received the Hannah Arendt Award 2023. Congratulations.
Thank you.
We had agreed to have this conversation long before the publication of your essay on the shadow of the Holocaust in the New Yorker and the Hannah Arendt Award ceremony here in Germany. And I had originally invited you as an analyst of Vladimir Putin and the war in Ukraine. And I would like to focus on that in our conversation, at least in the beginning. And I would like to use Hannah Arendt for our conversation so that we try to think with Arendt throughout. Shortly before the Hannah Arendt Award, the news broke that Russia presses criminal charges against you for, I quote, spreading knowingly false information about the Russian army. The case states, and I quote again, according to the information from the Russian General Staff, the information about the mass murder of civilians by the service members, accompanied by the cases of looting, kidnappings, and torture in March of 2022 in the town of Bucha during the special military operation, is not true. I first of all would like to know, how did you learn about the fact that there are criminal charges pressed against you?
That's actually a great question, because the way I learned it originally was there was a news item on a pro-government Telegram channel sometime in September. And it was picked up by all the government media in Russia. But the lawyers that I'm regularly in touch with, for various reasons, looked and said, we don't see you in any of the databases. And it took us a month to find the case. And the way that one finds the case is that I had to then formally engage a lawyer in Moscow, which is not easy because a lawyer in Moscow cannot receive money from abroad. So a proxy had to enter into a legal arrangement with this lawyer on my behalf. And then the lawyer had to query the central apparatus of the investigative committee. And then they said, we don't have anything. And then she started querying regional investigative committees and found my case in a Moscow court. And one of the first reactions that I had to that was... Once I knew that it was true, and it was in the independent media, and the reason it was in the independent media was that they were waiting for confirmation from me that we actually found the case. So once it came out in the media, one of the first reactions I got was from a friend of mine who wrote, "You're lucky you found your case. I've been looking for mine for 4 months." So it's not an atypical story. My friend's story was that he found himself, or rather some Russian journalists found him on the list of extremists and terrorists. So it's a whole production. And there's a wonderful independent Russian publication called Media Zone, which was founded by the members of Pussy Riot when they got out of prison, which tracks prisoners' rights and criminal cases, particularly political cases. And one of the things they do is they crawl these public databases. So the databases of people who have search warrants out for them, the databases of people who are declared extremists and terrorists. So they had found my friend's name on the list of extremists and terrorists, and now he and his lawyer have been looking for months to find his case. A couple of weeks ago, they found the place where his case is, but they still can't find the actual case.
Can I ask, as someone who is definitely not an expert on Russia, and can I ask, what is the rationality of not, you know, publishing these indictments or these criminal charges? Or is there no rationale? I mean, is even the question wrong?
No, I believe there's always logic. Even in the absence of logic, there's a logic. And I think this logic has something to do with the punishment being more important than the object of punishment. So my friend, whom I mentioned, is a very prominent LGBT journalist. He has an LGBT YouTube show. He really sort of broke open that space in Russia. That fact requires a reaction from Russian law enforcement. They're probably aware that he's abroad, so they have to react to his show more than to him himself. If they happen to find him at his place of residence, they'd arrest him. But in this way, sort of contemporary Russian political repression, I don't think we're quite at the level of terror, although that's arguable, is different from Stalinist terror because there are no show trials. That's not the point. The point is to sort of keep the machine working and meeting out punishment. When the people are there, they arrest them. When the people are not there, they don't arrest them. And of course, part of the objective also is to keep people out of the country.
Arendt wrote in The Origins of Totalitarianism that a totalitarian regime is lawless, but not arbitrary. Is that here the case, or is it maybe even the other way around, that it's lawful and arbitrary?
You know what? I disagree with that phrase, and I think that she actually contradicts herself in The Origins of Totalitarianism when she describes political terror. I think in the intervening 70 years, we've come to understand terror a little bit better, partly through psychological studies on a much smaller scale than the studies of government. And I think terror absolutely has to be arbitrary. Otherwise, it's not terror. And that's actually why I said that I think, to me, there's a really interesting question about whether Russia has already gone over into terror. And I would say that the difference between terror and tyranny, and this is where I think she's contradictory, is that terror creates a situation in which there is a credible threat against every single person in society. Non-arbitrary lawlessness does not create that threat. And elsewhere, aren't in the origins of totalitarianism, Arendt writes that the difference between totalitarianism and tyranny is that under tyranny, there are behaviors and statements that are demanded of you, what we would now call performance, that that keeps you safe. Whereas under totalitarianism, nothing performative keeps you safe. That's how totalitarianism gets on the inside. This is how totalitarianism robs people of their ability to think and form opinions.
And here in this case, I would also say, in this particular case, I would say, well, Russia is using the law. It is bringing criminal charges. It is bringing a case. It argues the case also. So law is used to bring about fear and punishment. Now, my question would be, if you look at your own work, how arbitrary do you think it is to get indicted, or how rational from Putin's perspective is it that you are chosen to be indicted?
So first of all, I would propose that we make a distinction between lawful and legalistic.
Yes, fair enough.
And I think that, so yes, Russia uses law, as a lot of contemporary autocracies do. And here I would particularly point to Israel, which uses law in super interesting ways. But it is to create not a lawful regime, but a legalistic regime. Right? There will always be a law that they can use against you, but it doesn't stem from the law.
Mm-hmm.
So as for the logic of prosecuting or trying to prosecute me rather than anyone else, on the one hand, they're fairly consistent in the sense that they go after opposition activists and journalists for making statements such as I made about war crimes in Bucha. And actually, while we're on the subject of legalistic measures, I want to pause for a second to talk about the indictment, which I think is such an incredible document. So it consists of three paragraphs. The first paragraph says that in an interview in
September
September 2022. Now, the reason they're using the interview rather than the article itself is because the crime has to be committed in Russian.
In the Russian language.
Yes.
Maybe you should say what kind of an interview it was, because not everybody on the program would know. So it was in a conversation with, I hope I pronounced the name correctly, Yuri Dud. Is that?
Yes. His name is Yuri Dud. He's a super popular YouTuber.
With millions of followers.
Millions of followers, who does these epic interviews and really gets an absolutely extraordinary audience. So he is on their radar, and I'm by far not the first person to have been prosecuted after giving him an interview. But I also think that Russia may well have wanted to prosecute me earlier for articles in The New Yorker, but couldn't because they're in English. And because the regime is legalistic, it actually follows some of these obscure rules. So English is not a state language of Russia. If I gave the interview in, or if I wrote the article in Russian, or one of the Chechen languages or whatever, then it could have been prosecutable. So the first paragraph says that in this interview, I said that Russian soldiers in Bucha killed civilians and marauded. And then the next paragraph is the one you read out, which is that according to the general staff, this is false. And then the third paragraph is, according to psycholinguistic expertise, my statements contain elements of the crime of knowingly spreading false information. And this goes back to the first week of the full-scale invasion, when Russia adopted a set of laws, the first of which required all media to use only information supplied by the Ministry of Defense or the General Staff in discussing the what they call the special military operation. And then the next couple of laws created penalties for not doing that. So basically what they're saying, and the reason I'm so fascinated with this is, of course, because it's this beautiful totalitarian document where it says, this is what we say the truth is. And because this is what we said the truth is, you're a criminal.
Could you, I mean, we should say, first of all, you hold a dual citizenship. Is that correct? You are Russian and an American citizen. Is that correct?
Yes. And I had the option of giving up my Russian citizenship before the case, but now I don't.
Could I ask you, what does this indictment, I mean, practically mean? Or, I mean, what does it, I mean, maybe ask differently, what does it do to you? Yeah, I mean, you've been analyzing it sort of, you know, as if it were something that affected others, and it does affect others, of course, but what does it do to you?
Well, it has some practical consequences. I'd say three sets of practical consequences. One is that the reason I didn't give up my Russian citizenship in the last year and a half, when it's been commonsensically unsafe for me to go back to Russia, is that I wanted to be able to get on the first plane to Russia when there is a change of regime, whether it's when Putin dies or there's a coup or anything else. So that plan has been foiled, because whatever change of regime happens, I doubt that their first priority will be to take me off the wanted list. In all likelihood, this means I will never be able to go back to Russia. So that's consequence number one.
Can you say what that means or what that does?
It's my home. I've gone from the state of the long game of sitting it out to never being able to go home again. The second consequence is more sort of present day. It means that eventually, so they've now issued a search warrant for me. Then after they decide that they didn't find me, they're going to arrest me in absentia and then try me in absentia and then sentence me to somewhere between 7.5 and 10 years, which is the standard sentence for this kind of so-called crime in Russian courts. And then they will put out an Interpol warrant. So there's a hassle of I have to take measures to notify Interpol ahead of time that this is a politically motivated warrant to try to prevent the heavy consequences of it. But it really narrows my travel options. There are countries, including countries where I have very close friends, where people get extradited or just simply kidnapped.
So India or Indonesia, or I mean, those are the countries that I think.
In the very immediate sense, it's Armenia, Georgia, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, countries where I would want to go to see friends or to report in Azerbaijan. Russians just kidnapped somebody in Armenia and brought him to prison in Russia. So this is a known risk factor. And more abstractly, countries that have extradition treaties that they appear to be observing include, yes, most of Southeast Asia, China, some of Latin America, and a lot of Africa. That's actually a lot of the world. So, and I also said there was a third consequence. Oh, yeah, the third consequence is nebulous, which is even countries that don't extradite, such as the countries of the European Union and the United States, are countries where Russians have assassins who have been killing people and unsuccessfully trying to assassinate people on a pretty large scale. So being on the wanted list of a country that sends assassins to the Western world is not a cozy feeling.
Hannah Arendt wrote in her essay on we refugees, she says that we, I'm translating actually now lousily from the German edition. In German, it's wir büßen unser Selbstvertrauen ein, wenn uns die Gesellschaft nicht schützt, which is something like we lose our self-confidence if the society does not protect us. Could you elaborate on the sense of unprotectedness that you might feel in connection with this indictment?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that that's something that I feel, to be honest. I am not, I live in exile, but I'm not a refugee in the Arendtian sense. I'm very rooted where I live. And I think that I've always said, whenever I've been asked, and I, you know, certainly over the last 20 years, I've frequently been asked about my feelings about my safety. And I've always said that I'm safer than people that the questioner has never heard about. I think that's mostly still true. Russia ranks probably highest. I say probably only because of what's going on in Gaza right now. But Russia has historically ranked highest on the Committee to protect Journalists Impunity Index, and which is, I think, self-explanatory. And if you look on the list of journalists who have died in Russia or by Russia's hands, you've never heard of them. In general, prominence protects people. I'm not exactly sure how it functions. So I think that's still to a large extent true, but you know, the things that I have to consider now is, now that there's evidence I just learned about today, that they're now operating in New York, I have to figure out how to delist my address from being from public databases, that sort of thing. And again, I think that's an instrument that's accessible to me. I have the connections and the wherewithal to do it. I'm much more worried about the literally scores of Russian journalists who have temporary status or no status in the countries where they're living and who really are left completely unprotected under similar circumstances.
I would like to speak a little bit about Russia, about the situation in Russia and about the war. I'm this is not an area of the world that I know very well. My impression is that I hear not enough about Russia itself, that I hear a lot about the war, about the front lines, you know, about the trenches, about the weapons, but not enough about life, about civil society, about the people inside Russia. It seems to me it's not invisible, but there's a lack of information, at least for someone like me. So I would like to hear a little bit more from you about Russia. And the first question is, how do you get your informations about what's going on in Russia?
You know, I don't think I have enough information. And that's part of the reason that you are not hearing a lot about Russia. Russia's strategy of shutting out all independent Russian journalists and a majority of foreign journalists has been very effective. They really have brought the information space fully under control. And, you know, just to give you an idea of how severe it is, I mean, my grandmother was the censor for foreign correspondence working in Moscow from 1946 until 1957. And because I wrote a book about my grandmother's, I really immersed myself in the world of Stalinist censorship. And I would say that the instruments are different. but it's comparable. When my grandmother was the censor, the instruments were isolating credit correspondence. They lived in basically a compound, and they had very little access to anybody who wasn't supplied to them by the Soviets. Some were enterprising and figured things out or made friends. And this is where the censorship came in, because all of their dispatches had to go through my grandmother, who would be crash taught a language every time they accredited a new correspondent, which was her favorite part of the job. And now there's no official censorship, but the isolation is pretty similar. It is achieved by, you know, they basically stripped all American and most British journalists of accreditation. Then they allowed a few back in, but they've created an atmosphere of absolute terror, especially by arresting Evan Gershkovich, who was a Wall Street Journal correspondent. And it was very clear there was a message that he had strayed too far from interviewing officials in Moscow. He went to Yekaterinburg and was actually doing enterprise reporting there. So he's now in jail facing espionage charges that carry a 20-year sentence, a potential 20-year sentence. And then they do exactly what they used to do back in the Soviet Union, which is they take, having created this extremely constrained space, they now take correspondents on tour. So, for example, Roger Cohn of the New York Times went to Russia for a month and had a reporting trip entirely curated by the Kremlin. Not a thing that I think the New York Times should have done. But I also understand why they did it, because that's the only way to report on Russian life. So,
well, it could be interesting. I mean, it could be interesting to write about what such curated tours right. are like.
But of course, they took somebody who, even though he has a lot of foreign reporting expertise, has no Russia expertise. So it's hard for him to write something like that critically. And this, of course, is right out of the Soviet playbook. You may be familiar with Leon Feitfinger's book written in 1937, The Height of the Great Terror, which was the result of such a curated tour. So now how I get information? I, through social media, through Telegram channels. I still have a little bit of family in Russia. I can't really say that I have friends in Russia anymore, because most of the friends whom I would call friends left in the first week of the full-scale invasion. So I have acquaintances.
Could you describe in Arendtian terms who had a very strong concept of the public sphere, of the role of the public, of the role of the Respublica, and a very strong idea of what private realm or private space was. Could you describe in Arendtian terms what's happening to the public spaces or to private spaces at the moment?
Right. So, public spaces have been systematically destroyed over the last 23 years. But particularly, of course, in the last couple of years. And that encompasses a variety of things that we may think of as public spaces. Certainly there are political spaces. Those were destroyed first. Civil society spaces came second. But, wherever people might have met for a political conversation or a conversation about history, which of course is also a political conversation, those were systematically destroyed. And I think I can say with some confidence, no longer exist as of 2 years ago. And cultural space. Theaters have been raided and theater directors have been arrested and I suspect killed on two occasions. And so that right now, one of the most promising young theater directors, Zhenya Berkovich. Zhenya Berkovich and the playwright she was working with, Svetlana Polishuk, they're both in prison. I can't even remember for under what ridiculous charges, but facing long prison terms. And the same, I'm not even going to mention media because I think people are quite aware of how that's played out. And now they're going after book publishing, two of Russia's most popular writers, both of whom live in exile, Dmitry Bykov and Boris Akunin, were declared extremists in the last couple of days. Their publishers have pulped their books and their bookstores have dumped them in the space of 2 days, in part spurred by searches. But also, and this to me is most striking, what Russians call thick journals, which are, you know, basically literary journals that live up to their names, have gone back and cleaned up their electronic archives to excise these two writers. Now, again, we're talking about the two most popular writers in the country. So that's quite an extraordinary thing that we're witnessing. Again, on par with something that we would have seen in the 1940s and 50s, when people would be excised, for example, from the Great Soviet Encyclopedia after they were imprisoned. And, you know, at the time, subscribers to the encyclopedia would get a package in the mail that instructed them to take a razor blade, cut the relevant page out of the encyclopedia, and paste in the page that they had received in the mail with another encyclopedia article. So, for example, instead of Beria, who was one of Stalin's henchmen, who was then executed after the death of Stalin, people got a page for Beaver. So,
but there's limits to how much you can censor or control the information about the war in Ukraine. I mean, you cannot control death. You cannot control, you know, the fact that there's sons and brothers and husbands and fathers who are dying.
You know, this is actually where I think Arendt's insights are particularly useful, because she writes a lot about, well, not a lot, but I think that some of her most valuable insights about totalitarianism come at the very end of the book. And it's the last section of the last chapter, and it's on loneliness. And if we put it in terms of public and private, the destruction of public space creates loneliness. Loneliness is not the inability to be in the company of others, but it is the inability to be in the company of others in a meaningful way.
To act in concert.
To act in concert, to think in public. And she goes further and says that thinking under totalitarianism is all but impossible, precisely because of loneliness. And so what does that mean for a woman whose son is killed, what the authorities insist on calling the special military operation? She has no instruments for thinking about it. If she doesn't know that it's happened to others because it's not in the papers, because she has no community space in which to share it with other women or other families, then it's her personal tragedy. And at some point, she may face a choice about this personal tragedy, which is, does she think of it as something that the regime has done to her? Does she think of it as the result of the war? And in doing so, does she pay an even higher psychic price? Because whatever connections she does have will be threatened by this, by taking this position. Or does she treat it as her isolated personal tragedy? And by doing so, does she maintain at least a sense of belonging to something greater? Even if it's just as so little as turning on the TV and joining in this military fervor instead of questioning it in her most vulnerable moment.
And you think that's what's happening?
I think that's what's happening. I think we see some exceptions to it. And I think that if we look closely at where the exceptions occur, they occur where social ties remain. So the first place for where people, where women in particular, really started raising their voices was in Dagestan, a place with a lot of clan cohesion and just general social cohesion because it's largely rural still. But you know, in this sort of normal post-Soviet urban space where people can live in a 9-story apartment block for decades without knowing their neighbors, it's much less likely to occur.
I would like to speak a little bit about fear. Fear in Hannah Arendt is an anti-political concept, but I'm also interested in fear in a different sense. If you remember Svetlana Alexievich's book on Chernobyl, it was to me most valuable in the description of people being so afraid within this authoritarian system that they were afraid to report the truth about what's going on to the next level. And so somehow fear wasn't really a stabilizing factor, but it was to some extent, I don't know if it was subverting it, but it was dysfunctional. I mean, fear seemed to create a dysfunctionality of the system. Could you describe how you see that develop at the moment? Is there something dysfunctional, something that threatens this stability of Putin? And if I may add, is it maybe Putin's own fears?
Again, I would amend Arendt a little bit, because I think that in the intervening 70 years, we've developed a finer vocabulary for what she was describing. And I think that totalitarianism functions by inflicting anxiety. Fear has an object. You can be afraid of something specific. You can be afraid that they're going to come for you, for example. You can be afraid of getting killed, arrested, whatever. Anxiety is a state in which the subject of a totalitarian state walks around, where everything is fraught. And if you were asked the question, what is the worst thing that could happen, the person wouldn't be able to answer. And I think what Alexievich is describing is anxiety. It's not fear. None of the people that she talks about would be able to say exactly what kind of consequences for what they fear. They just know that they're supposed to stay quiet and not disturb the sort of the general state of things as they are. And so in that sense, I don't think it's a destabilizing factor. It's a stabilizing factor. It's essential for the existence of the totalitarian regime is to keep everybody in a state of inaction. Like, people can function to the extent that they can go to work and take care of their families, but they can't, as you and I can't, in a state of anxiety, make plans for the future, think critically, speak up, and even as in Chernobyl, recognize when something extraordinary has happened, unless you're told from the top that that's what happened, which is why I find my indictment to be such a great document. So yes, that people in Russia are in that state. And that state is created by the constant political pressure, by the general tenor of things, right? Because I can't call these things any of the normal names like public space or television or journalism. But if you turn on the television in Russia, people are screaming. They're screaming about the war. They're screaming about Americans. They're screaming about Ukrainian Nazis. You know, they're constantly screaming.
About everybody. Gender.
I'm sorry?
About gender.
About gender, absolutely, yes. Thank you for mentioning that. Gender is, of course, a huge instrument of creating this anxiety because it plays into, usually in the same sentence that they talk about so-called Ukrainian Nazis, they also talk about the gender ideology. And that taps right into people's fears that their children will be strangers to them.
Will be people like us. Let's.
Yes. Their children will be people like us. Yeah. Which is why occasionally there's a spate of articles about me or people like us because I look scary to Russians. Right. That's sort of one aspect. And another thing, of course, that causes the anxiety is the results of Western sanctions. The results, Western sanctions have been completely toothless against the war machine. The government can still sell all the oil and gas that it wants and procure all the dual-use technologies and weapons that it wants. And it has money. But the people are, they're staring at extreme inflation, shortages, and a general sense of instability.
And is that threatening? I'm looking for what could be a threat to Putin, what could destabilize his regime.
Right. So this is where we get to Putin's fears. And I think Putin's fears also stabilize the regime.
Stabilize or destabilize?
They stabilize it. And this is how. It's true that Putin can be threatened by... there are two fantasies about how Putin's regime collapses. The fantasy number one is that people dissatisfied with the results of economic sanctions rise up and bring him down. That's ridiculous. The other fantasy is that the elites, squeezed by economic sanctions and their assets being seized in the West and not being able to travel to the West, that they rise up and bring Putin down. I call it a fantasy advisedly because I think that it fundamentally misunderstands the nature of the regime, which is that there aren't elite groups functioning. There is one patron who distributes money and power. And so if the pie gets smaller, then the challenge is to get closer to the center, not to form bonds of solidarity. However, after the Prigozhin uprising, the Prigozhin mutiny in June, which did not have as its goal bringing down Putin's regime, there were clear indications that there are at least some people in the elites who want to get Western assurances that if they depose Putin, they will be able to immediately start talking to the West and cooperating with the West. That creates a small chance that something will actually happen. But Putin is paranoid. We see signs of that paranoia in everything, right? Starting from how he can't sit closer than 3 meters to any one person. To, you know, when, I can't remember who's, oh, it was Zhirinovsky's funeral. When Putin went to the casket, the honor guard were removed. Right? He's afraid of the million times vetted soldiers who would be standing by the casket. And of course, he's the sort of the other end of the spectrum is his constant overreaction to any sign of protest, as though some 21-year-old in St. Petersburg who came out with a 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper against the war threatens the stability of the regime.
So he's afraid of democracy. He's afraid of.
Of course, he's afraid of democracy, but he's also just paranoid, and his paranoia is miles ahead of any actual threat that he could face. And so, because of his paranoia, he is likely to take precautions before anybody can possibly bring him down, which is why I think that the possibility of a palace coup is it's greater than the possibility of a popular uprising, but it's still very low.
But what kind of prospects, really, do you see, or scenarios do you see for the war in Ukraine? We haven't until now talked about the suffering of the Ukrainian people. We haven't talked about the losses of the Ukrainian people so far. But what kind of scenarios can you imagine for the Ukraine?
It's looking very dark to me. From fairly early in the war, when the original plan to take over Ukraine in 2 or 3 days failed, Russia went into basically a forever war mode. For Putin, anything that's not an outright defeat, which means he loses Crimea, anything else is either a success or tolerable. So he can continue this war indefinitely. For Ukraine, it's the opposite. Ukraine has to fight the war in the time available when it still has human resources and when it still has the support of the West. And both of those things are running out. Ukraine is running out of people. Who can fight. They haven't released any people who enlisted or were drafted in the first days of the war. They can't afford to. The average age of a Ukrainian soldier keeps inching up and up and up. And there are very few people to mobilize anymore. And U.S. aid is running out, and European aid is running out. So this was exactly the design. The Kremlin wanted to wait out the European consensus. And, of course, it's looking forward to seeing Trump get elected. But even after the midterm elections in the U.S., things started looking much brighter for Putin, and this was very much the analysis in the Kremlin. Was great. Now we can throw a wrench into congressional support for Ukraine. And on top of everything else, there's Israel, which is sucking up U.S. resources and U.S. goodwill.
Here in Germany, the discussion on the support for Ukraine has quite often focused on the legitimacy of Ukraine defending itself and it requiring, you know, solidarity, support, that only asking the question about exit strategies, asking the questions about, you know, negotiations asking the question about ceasefire have been very often here framed as a lack of solidarity, as a support for the Russian cause. What do you think about this? You know, how not just legitimate, but how necessary do you consider the question about the a strategy or about an exit scenario?
I think it's an immoral question for two very, very simple reasons. One is internal to Ukraine, which is that when you say to Ukrainians, can you negotiate to give Putin some land so that he will leave you alone? What you're saying to them is, can you give up your cousin, your aunt, your brother-in-law to the torture? And we know this, right? Torture, marauding, and other war crimes that are committed consistently under Russian occupation. That is an immoral question to ask. We're talking about millions, we don't know how many millions of people who are living under occupation or have been removed to Russia. We're not talking about land. That said, there are many people, there's a growing number of people in Ukraine who would go along with this. Which brings me to the second reason, which is external to Ukraine, which is that Russia doesn't want to negotiate. Putin doesn't need an exit strategy. Asking Ukrainians about this is ridiculous. It's not like, you know, it reminds me of the old Jewish joke about, do you know which one I'm going to?
No. I laugh already.
Yeah. So, you know, the matchmaker comes to the house of a peasant in Zhmerinka and says, you know, your youngest daughter, I would like to match her with Rothschild, the billionaire. And the man's like, oh, I don't know. She's young. I haven't married off my oldest daughter. But, you know, Rothschild, he's a billionaire. Like, all your problems would be gone. And he says, well, but he's old. He's like 60. And the matchmaker's like, yeah, but all your problems would be gone. And he's a good man. And he's not going to live that long. And so the man says, okay, all right, fine. I agree. She says, okay, now I just have to talk Rothschild into it. So Ukrainians may be willing to negotiate a million times over. Putin doesn't want to negotiate. And even if we imagine this very unlikely scenario in which Putin agrees to negotiate and they say stabilize a border along the current front line, that means we know that Putin cannot be trusted. This has happened before. We know that his ambition is to take over all of Ukraine. So basically, we're creating a situation for Ukraine in which they have to live in a state of forever frozen war. Perhaps a forever frozen war is better than a forever hot war, but it's not a lot better. And the consequences for Ukraine in terms of people coming back to the country when they see that that's what they're going back to, or being able to build anything and being able to rebuild, at this point it's rebuilding, its democratic mechanisms when they're under constant threat of war. You know, these are all really fraught propositions.
Could I ask a little bit also about you as a writer and in which sense, for us as writers, our own background matters, our experiences matter. You have just written about memorial culture, and as a writer, I would say this is indeed a historic background that informs my own self-understanding of a writer. I'm a queer writer. That does also inform my writer. I'm non-Jewish. You know, I'm the next generation. I think the Holocaust has, as a background, my understanding as a writer. And I would like to learn from you? You know, in which sense has your being Jewish, you're coming from a Jewish family, but also you're, you know, fleeing twice Russia, you as a non-binary person, how much does the historic background and how much does your identity influence your writing?
I mean, you know, the honest answer is I don't know, because I haven't been any other kind of writer. I can hypothesize that being an outsider everywhere I've ever reported on is, for the most part, a good thing.
In which sense? Can you explain that? In which sense is being an outsider a good thing?
I think, you know, and I've been thinking about this a lot in the context of exile, and especially exile thinkers. I think that exile is always, you could think of it as a loss of innocence, but it's, and by innocence, I mean accepting that things are as they are and always have been and always will be. It's an exile has a catastrophic imagination. An exile always knows that things are not always, have not always been this way and will not always be this way. And is less likely, I think, to naturalize things. I think an exile notices things that that somebody who swims in the same water all their life is less likely to notice as strange. So the act of estrangement comes naturally to the exile. There are obvious disadvantages too. So much of our profession depends on being immersed, being connected, catching subtleties that may be less accessible for an exile.
It's interesting. I would have always thought for myself as a queer writer who traveled to regions of crisis that I would say that we have a particular sense of vulnerability, of our bodies being, you know, vulnerable. And I think I also have a probably from that queerness, the knowledge of what it means to be very, very careful about what to say and when and whom to trust and how both are scary to tell the truth might be, but also how liberating it might be. Is that something that you could relate to? That you also feel when reporting, when listening, it's when listening to others.
Of course, and I think especially the part about the body, which you've written about beautifully, resonates with me because I think a lot of the time in times of crisis, people divorce their bodies. And act as though they were disembodied. It's good to pretend that you don't have a body when it's the body that's threatened. But I think queerdom makes it much more difficult to pretend that you don't have a body. And so yes, I think it may make us more alive to the vulnerability of others.
In the last essay that you wrote, and that was criticized a lot and caused controversy here in this country. I'm actually less interested in the question of metaphor and comparison and analogy, but I am really interested in the question of how are we? And we not only as Germans, but we as universalists, how are we supposed to think with history? You know, what kind of information, what kind of appeal, what kind of obligation should we take from history?
Well, I think that actually we know exactly what kind of obligation we take from history, because it has been put very succinctly, never again. And the never, the object of never again is known. And I think our obligation is to continue thinking that it's possible, perhaps even likely. And, you know, I think this, I referred earlier to catastrophic imagination, and I don't think that means fatalism and the belief in utter doom. It's knowing that history is not linear, and knowing that it's contingent, and its contingency means that we're acting in history all the time.
But is it relevant for taking these lessons seriously, each generation again? Is it relevant who I am or who my family was? And I ask that also because you are, you know, a migrant in the United States. So how much do you take that particular history as your, you know, as one that you have to reflect on? And the same question, I think, is very often asked here for migrants who come to Germany. You know, how much do they have to, you know, take this history that isn't the history of their parents, that isn't the history of their grandparents, to somehow also mark a history or a historic understanding for themselves?
It may be a question that's actually easier to answer in the American context, and maybe it couldn't illuminate the German context a little bit. I don't think that anybody who lives today has historical responsibility for things that happened before they were born.
There we have a disagreement. Oh, okay.
In the sense that I don't think that a German, you know, a 40-year-old German or an immigrant to Germany is responsible directly for the actions of their grandparents. What we do have responsibility for is recognizing the structures that resulted from that history and our place in those structures.
And that's how you also feel about the U.S.?
That's how I feel about the U.S. You know, what is, you know, I'm a Jewish, queer, trans immigrant to the United States. I am obviously not in any sense a descendant of slave owners. I am also a wealthy white person living in New York. And in that sense, I benefit greatly from the structures created by slavery. And so that to me is the difference between historical responsibility and responsibility in the present day. And it also makes it much easier to place an immigrant in that context. How much does an Israeli living in Berlin benefit from the structures of contemporary Germany compared to a Palestinian of the same age living in Berlin? Their relationship to actual Nazism in history is probably flipped by now in terms of their relationship to the current structures.
That's interesting, because I would have said that if I take maybe famous memorials and I take two of the ones that are closest to my heart, I would say the memorial in Portbou, Spain, by the Israeli artist Denny Karavahan on remembering Walter Benjamin, who killed himself while trying to flee Nazi Germany. And maybe take another example from the US, which is the lynching memorial in Montgomery, Alabama. And I would say, without comparing, we could even compare and say they're not the same, but without equalizing, so to speak, the atrocities that they are there to remember And even though, as a non-Jewish German, I have a very strong sense of obligation that stems from that particular history, and it is a particular history, and yet they both have an enormous effect on me. They both create an incredible sense of pain and melancholy, and I do feel equally universally obliged. So maybe that is a way to say there are very particular histories, that they are singular, and yet we can analyze the structures in them, and they could constitute a similar ethical, moral, universal obligation. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I think that the power of those memorials is that they both remind us of what humanity is capable of at its worst. And if they remind us of it effectively, as I think they do, they resist being thought of as things of the past, as merely memorials to something that happened a long time ago.
Yes, I agree. I think.
Just to be more clear, the lynching memorial in Montgomery is not a reminder of what white American Southerners are capable of. It's a reminder of what humans are capable of. And that's where the universalism comes in.
I agree. And of course, the Portbou Memorial also is what humans in general are capable of. And yet still, it does have a particular effect on me. It does, for me, remain a singular, very particular crime for which I do feel a very particular responsibility and obligation.
I think you can feel both. I think both things can be true at the same time.
Yeah. Let me, first of all, thank you very, very much, Masha, for engaging and thinking together with me. It's a great honor and joy.
The honor is mine.
And I do hope we can continue to think together. I think it's important to find, even in times of such controversies, in times of such pain, to sharpen the contours maybe of the differences, but also find the common ground. So I thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you. This was an incredible pleasure.
Always I ask my guests in this podcast if they could give one recommendation for a book that you've read recently, a film that you've seen, a Netflix series, a concert, something that you might like to share with our audience.
So I'm going to share something perhaps a little unexpected, which is a new Showtime series called Fellow Travelers. It's about two gay men, and it spans American history from the McCarthy era to the AIDS epidemic.
Is it a miniseries or?
It's an eight episode miniseries that is perhaps the first cultural product I've ever seen that manages to be, but one of the few that manage to be incredibly politically and psychologically astute about some of our worst tendencies, like the McCarthy hearings and what it did to people, to their morality, and just unbelievably hot. It's a celebration of sex.
Can you say the title again?
It's called Fellow Travelers.
Okay. It's Showtime.
It's Showtime. It's an 8-episode miniseries, and the last episode just landed maybe a week ago.
Okay. Thanks very, very much, Masha Gessen. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Und das war es auch schon wieder mit dieser Folge von In aller Ruhe. Wenn Sie mehr über Masha Gessen erfahren wollen, dann schauen Sie auf sz.de/in aller Ruhe. Dort finden Sie auch alle bisherigen Gespräche von In aller Ruhe. Die nächste Folge kommt wie gewohnt in 2 Wochen, also am 27. Januar. Vielen Dank für die Unterstützung und Produktion dieser Folge an das gesamte Team der Süddeutschen Zeitung und Ihnen vielen Dank fürs Zuhören.